Hello, my friends. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. There are many vitally important questions in life, but there is one that since I was a child I have always realized has no question that is more important, and that is there something after this life? I am astounded that there are people who say they don't care or who just dismiss the idea as wishful thinking on the part of a religious people. I don't think you have to be religious, and I don't think that you have to be a philosopher to understand how significant it is. I mean, if there is no afterlife, if nothing happens, if this is it, all there is, then life ultimately is a total crapshoot. Whether you suffer totally or you prosper is just a matter of fortune, and there is no ultimate justice. The torturer and his victim have the same fates. Even as a kid, I realized that there has to be something beyond this. So when a scientist writes that there is something beyond this because of his own experience, it seems to make headlines. In this case, I believe it was a front page cover story in Newsweek magazine. And the man who was responsible for this is an academic neurosurgeon and at the Brigham and Women's and the Children's Hospitals and Harvard Medical School in Boston, Dr. Aben Alexander. The book is Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. Dr. Alexander, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Well, thank you, Dennis. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Let me ask you first, what would you have, when did you have this experience, which obviously we'll delineate in a moment? When did you have it?
I had it 4 years ago right now. Just wanted to clarify, I'm not at the Brigham and Women's and Harvard Medical School in the Brigham now, but I was there from 1988 to 2001.
Okay, thank you. You're right. The bio on your book says has been.
Right.
But you're not a has-been. I just want to make that clear.
No, that's what this is all about.
You're a will-be.
I'm an am, like we all are.
That's right. All right. So the reason I asked when this happened is, if I'd have had you on my show 10 years ago, not in the last four, and asked you, Doctor, I'm just curious, do you believe in an afterlife? What would you have said?
Well, I would have said that that there is no way that any form of consciousness could exist after the death of the brain and the body.
Right, exactly. Okay, that's what I assumed you would have said. What happened that changed your mind?
Well, about a little over 4 years ago right now, one morning it was as if I had been struck by a freight train. I woke up, had severe back pain, and then rapidly went on to develop an excruciating headache, and by that point I was already too far gone to even put it together. My son, Bond, came in to rub my head and felt like he'd driven a white-hot spike right through it, and I guess about the last words I said, my wife, Holly, wanted to call 911, and I said, don't call 911, just a muscle spasm. Trust me, I'm a doctor, that kind of thing. And then the next thing she knew, I was lapsing into unconsciousness. And then she saw me having a grand mal seizure, and she did call 911.
All right. What was the cause of this?
Well, they took me off to the ER. I was already in coma, but I was very quickly suspected to have acute bacterial meningitis, and in fact, they confirmed that. And I was put on a ventilator in an ICU for the next 7 days. I was deep in coma from before the ambulance even got to our house. Don't remember anything of those 7 days from the earthly realm. And I had an extraordinary experience deep in coma when the meningitis should have disabled all experience except for the most kind of mundane, rudimentary forms of awareness. And yet I had a very rich journey that was more real and profound than what my brain could muster even now.
It was more real and profound than the three-dimensional universe you and I inhabit?
Yes, very much so. And, of course, that was a shocking aspect of it. And the meningitis was so effective at wiping out the human part of my brain that, in fact, when I was deep in coma, I had no memory whatsoever of my life before, my life on Earth before coma. And yet I went through this beautiful, extraordinary journey, spiritual journey, deep in coma, that included meeting the divine and having lessons about all of how this is put together and constructed and the purpose for all of this in higher dimensional space, and then came back to this realm.
I have to say that it's a little sad to me that you didn't have any recollection in that realm of your earthly existence. Does that mean, or at least do you interpret that now as meaning that in the afterlife we have none of the bonds that we make in this life endure?
No, in fact, I would say just the opposite. I think in many ways one has to see my experience, and I point all this out in the book, it's kind of the exception that proves the rule. I think this journey happened for a reason. Of course, it took me more than 2 years to get to that point because initially I was trying to write it up as a neuroscientific report about the ultra-reality deep in coma when I should have had no experience at all. But then I came to realize just what the bigger message was and that it was far grander than just a little neuroscientific report of that ultra-reality that's often described in near-death experiences. I would say that, in fact, when you read my story and get through to the very end and realize what's happened, that it points out that even though I had a somewhat anomalous journey by having this very fortuitous temporary amnesia for my life in the physical realm, it all served a much grander purpose because it had to happen that way for me to realize to understand the reality or ultra-reality of that experience and of that realm and how it really happened outside of my brain.
So do you feel that you were chosen?
Well, like I said, it took me more than 2 years to finally get to a point where I thought, well, maybe this did happen for a reason, although I resisted that tremendously for a long time. I mean, especially when it was all about writing this up as a neuroscientific report and discussing it with my colleagues, trying to come up with explanations for how this might have happened in my brain, which is what I thought. When I first came back, I was stunned by the experience, just like everyone is. But on the other hand, I thought that there must be some brain-based explanation. And so I went back to my neuroscientific roots and tried to come up with an explanation within my brain. And because I had such a severe meningitis, in fact, none of the hypotheses work to explain it that way.
So one of the most obvious questions is, how have your colleagues reacted?
Well, I would say there are two kind of scenarios where they seem to respond pretty favorably. One is if they are at all versed in consciousness. And I can tell you I had to learn a lot about consciousness far beyond what I ever had to know as a neurosurgeon. Because in neurosurgery, you know, there are a few things that we know, and we certainly think we have a good idea of the kind of things that turn off consciousness. But you have to remember that we've been using general anesthesia for over 150 years, and yet we have no clue how general anesthesia works to turn off consciousness. And that should be a pretty good clue about how little we actually know about consciousness. And so that's one group are the neurosurgeons. If I have 10 or 15 minutes to talk with them about the hard problem of consciousness, as it's known to science, which is basically saying that nobody on earth can begin to describe to you how consciousness comes up out of the brain. Physical, if you know the physics, chemistry, biology of the human brain, you'd like to think that then somebody can explain how consciousness comes out of all that. And yet nobody can. It's a complete mystery. And that's very important for people to understand because that's right at the core of my understanding of my experience now. The other thing is the enigma of quantum mechanics, which drove the founding fathers of that field into mysticism because it suggested that consciousness plays a tremendous role in painting reality, and yet they couldn't understand that.
Explain that when we come back.
Okay.
I'm speaking to Dr. Eben Alexander. Proof of Heaven is his best-selling book, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. To say that this is an important subject is to understate the case considerably. I don't think there's anything more important. Hence the time I'm devoting to the scientist and this subject. I'm Dennis Prager. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show, and I am speaking to Dr. Eben Alexander. His book is a huge bestseller. I don't normally have the authors of bestsellers on because they're usually not significant books. It just works out that way. This, however, is both a bestseller and a significant book. It's titled Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. And again, I just want to bring my listeners up to speed here. You are a neurosurgeon, and you were affiliated at the time. Is that right, at the time you were, or is you had already left Harvard?
Actually, I had left Harvard. This is 4 years ago. I was working as coordinating global research in focused ultrasound surgery for a foundation that was supporting that very innovative technique.
And you would have greeted a book by another neurosurgeon. You would have greeted this book with skepticism. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, I would say that, you know, if a patient had told me this before, had told me the story that I tell, I would have assured them that they were very sick and that... you know, we didn't think they were going to survive and not to take any of it seriously. But the important thing is that by seeing all that I saw within and seeing that ultra reality for all that it's worth, and then especially finding out just how sick I was with the meningitis and realizing there were certain clues about when certain events occurred and when these memories formed in my brain, I realized that this was very real and the experience was real, and came to realize how a large number of these near-death reports and afterlife reports going back 3,000 years occur in a real place. It's outside the physical universe. They don't happen in our brain, but our brain does some tainting of the information on the way back. That is, my personal and cultural background did reflect in what I brought back.
So you believe consciousness is independent of the brain?
Well, what I would say is we are conscious in spite of our brain, and that, in fact, the brain is a reducing valve or filter that reduces down a much higher level of consciousness that we get to when we're free of our brain. If, for instance, when we die and leave the brain and body behind, we are actually reunited with a much higher form of consciousness, which was really about the only way to explain my experience once I'd eliminated that it had happened in my brain.
Were you religiously active prior to the experience?
I had grown up in a Methodist church and wanted to believe in an afterlife and God and prayer. Used to say prayers with my sons. But I would say after 20 years in academic neurosurgery, I didn't see any way that consciousness could survive death of the body and brain, and I'd kind of given up on that. And also, I was adopted, and I had a kind of a psychic trauma around that and a rejection by my birth mother in the year 2000. I didn't realize till later, but that rejection basically crushed any hope of a personal loving God or of prayer. So for 8 years before my experience, I did not believe at all in a personal loving God or in any kind of benefit of prayer.
That's fascinating because it's a separate issue entirely, and I'd love to talk to you about that on another interview. Because I'm very interested in this subject on many levels because I don't believe that blood matters. I have an almost radical belief in that matter. I believe love matters far more than blood.
And it does.
Right. All right, fair enough. But usually it's girls who are more preoccupied with their adoption than boys.
Right. So, well, I had gotten used to the fact that my birth mother was out there somewhere and did not want to reunite. And I thought that was fine. You know, that just I looked for when I was younger. And North Carolina had pretty strict laws, and there was no sign that she wanted to reunite, so I let it go. It was actually my older son, who in 2000 was in the sixth grade doing a school project on family genealogy, they got me back into it, and he insisted that I write another letter to the children's home and try and find her.
Did you?
And I did, and of course, I was kind of shocked at what I found out, and that's part of what I report in the book.
Yeah. That's usually what happens. All right. Anyway, it's fascinating because I'm a one of my children is adopted, so it particularly fascinates me. But we'll have to leave that subject for now. So you had this experience, and now obviously, before time eludes us, what did you experience?
Well, deep in the middle of coma, I had no memory of my earthly life. In fact, I had no language, no words, no anything. And it all started in the realm that I call the Earthworm's Eye View, which was kind of a bubbling, muddy, foamy, monotonous, pounding, dark underground. And very unresponsive, as I said. I might, even though I had no language, I might wonder, you know, who, what, where. And there was never any kind of a response or answer at all. I felt like I was there a very long time because I had no memory of any prior existence. And then I was rescued from that by this spinning white light. It was a beautiful filamentous kind of golden white light that slowly came towards me, rotating. And then it had this lovely melody. And the notes of that melody were crucial later on. But at the time, it was just captivating and beautiful. And it served as a portal. It ripped open into a whole new reality that was far more real than where I had been, and by comparison was more real than even this earthly realm. But of course, I didn't know that at the time. I just knew what I was seeing at the time, and it was going up into a beautiful, brightly lit valley with flowers blossoming, buds opening, millions of butterflies. In fact, I had no body awareness, but I was a speck on this butterfly wing, and beside me was this beautiful girl, and the most comforting thoughts came from her, even though she never said a word, but looking at me with this lovely smile and sparkling blue eyes. You are loved, you are cherished deeply and forever. You have nothing to fear, and there's nothing you can do wrong in this realm.
What does that mean? You can do nothing wrong in which realm?
Well, what it meant at the time was that you could do nothing wrong in that spiritual realm. Because
not on Earth. You can't.
No, a lot of people get all bent out of shape.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, well, the issue, though, is in fact, though, strictly speaking, her words apply to Earth, too, if you realize that we are here to manifest that unconditional and infinite love of the Creator for fellow beings in spite of the injustice and imperfections of this realm, and realize we can either do that in our free will and choices and follow very directly towards that deification in the outer realm, or we cannot do that, and we can dish out evil and pain and mayhem.
All right, well, we'll continue on that. The book is up at DennisPrager.com, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. Aben Alexander, I'm Dennis Prager. I'm Dennis Prager, and I welcome you back. I'm speaking to a neurosurgeon, Dr. Aben Alexander, 15 years at Harvard Medical School, where he practiced his neurosurgery. The book is Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. He was struck suddenly with severe meningitis. The part of the brain involved with consciousness was, to use a layman's term, I guess, turned off, and he went into a coma for a week. But he had an experience during that time which confirmed for him the afterlife. The message you got, let's review that again. The message you got was you are loved.
Right. You are loved dearly forever. You are cherished. There is nothing you can do wrong. And again, by nothing you can do wrong, it was strictly speaking, it was in that realm, because one can definitely do plenty of wrong in this realm, as we were discussing. And in fact, the whole purpose for our existence is to manifest that free will and do the right thing in this realm, which has everything to do with forgiveness and compassion and serving as a conduit for that unconditional love out to our fellow beings in this very imperfect and unjust realm.
Here's an, it's not an odd question, but it, it may be one of the few you have not been asked. And I, but I mean it sincerely, because I do think about the, this issue, obviously. Could you imagine that experience for eternity? And I'm going to ask a very earthly question. Might it not get boring after 10,000 years?
Okay. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the most crucial features of this is to realize that from that outer realm, and this was very apparent to me, you know, from the beginning, I went through that gateway, the beautiful kind of earthly place with the beautiful girl and the butterfly and seeing angels and these pools of water and people dancing, you know, souls dancing below us. That was a gateway that was somewhat tainted by my brain when I came back and overlaid these kind of personal and cultural flavors onto my memories. But from there, it was outside of this universe, outside of the higher dimensional multiverse, and outside of all of time. I remember seeing Earth time, you know, or time in this universe collapse down into a, either a loop or a point, and realize that access from that outer realm was completely timeless. So, for example, I give in my book, I have that story of that wonderful friend of mine who is the chairman of one of the leading neurosurgical programs on Earth, academic neuroscientist, very brilliant man, who was wrestling with what he saw when his father passed over a year earlier. And he knew that his father saw the soul of his own mother, you know, the grandmother of my friend, who had passed over 65 years earlier. Now, what I can tell you is she wasn't sitting there watching the watch for 65 years waiting for that to happen. Okay, and in fact, when you understand how time flow in that realm and causality is completely separate and freed up from what we see as time flow, it starts to explain a lot of things about reincarnation, deathbed visions, near-death experiences, and encountering departed loved ones. I mean, all of that makes far more sense when you realize they're not going along with this little clock the way we are. And in fact, it's a much richer experience where, you know, I mean, you have to look at it that all of our time is compressed into nothing, and yet seconds of our time could be greatly expanded to allow for things in that realm. But that is the dominant realm, and that is the one that gives rise to what we see here.
Why is there a here if we end up there anyway?
Well, mainly this is what I call soul school. This is where our souls get done what they have to do. Out there, you know, we're privy to all of this, and all of us come to know this, the reality of that realm between lives when we leave this realm. And we can get to know it through deep meditation and centering prayer and things like that. You don't have to go through a near-death experience, have a very powerful, spiritually transformative experience that acknowledges the eternity of our spiritual selves. And so,
well, I'm going to ask you exactly about how the transformative experience affected you when we come back.
Okay.
Proof of Heaven is the book. It is up at DennisPrager.com, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, Dr. Aben Alexander. This is the Dennis Prager Show. With Dr. Aben Alexander, a neurosurgeon, 15 years at Harvard Medical School. Proof of Heaven is the book. It was a cover story of Newsweek. And it's a big bestseller, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. He had this experience while in a coma that can only be described as consciousness independent of the brain, and hence a journey into the afterlife. Before I ask you how it has transformed you, I'll ask you a question that I'm very, very curious to know your answer to. You obviously went to a realm that we would describe as heavenly. To be blunt, if a mass murderer went into a coma and had such experience, would he also have a heavenly experience?
Well, the thing is, when people commit that kind of evil and injustice and, you know, in any form, anything that varies from that unconditional love of the Creator, they end up facing their own higher soul and soul mates when they leave this life, in a life review. And they will end up feeling the pain and suffering they've dished out to others, but feel it far more powerfully than it was ever felt by their victims. So I would not say that people get off, that souls get off scot-free by serving as agents of that kind of mayhem and suffering to others. I mean, we end up...
Thank God.
Yeah,
end up... No, I'm very happy, really, to hear your answer, because I root for ultimate justice, and that means heaven for some, and I don't care what people call it, but something else for the people who have really done evil. I mean, otherwise, our sojourn here is morally meaningless if everybody has the same fate.
Well, in fact, what I would tell you is that my journey showed me that this life matters far more, has much more meaning and purpose than I ever would have thought before. And, you know, realizing that our souls are eternal and that it's not all about this kind of materialist mindset that everything is between birth and death and that's all there is to it, that we actually find that our reason for being here is far more important, and it has everything to do with manifesting that forgiveness, compassion, and that unconditional love of the Creator in everything that we do in this realm. And that is the only way that we actually progress as souls in that higher realm. You know, in the
spiritual. So by way of asking you, since you call it transformative, as I could well imagine it would be, I'm going to ask it to you in a slight variation of the way I was going to originally, and that I think most people would ask you, how has it transformed your life? I'm going to ask it in a different way.
Okay.
Looking back, how would you have led your life differently had you had this experience 20 years earlier?
Well, for one thing, I realize purpose of our being here, not just for ourselves, but then in fact it has so much more to do with our network of connections with our fellow souls and soulmates. And some of these could be just little chance encounters. You know, they don't have to be, you know, family members and those that we spend decades and decades with. So some of our soulmates, in fact, I came to realize that some of my soulmates previously I thought of as my nemesis in this life, that I saw them as somebody who was really causing me difficulty, and what I came to realize is that they were actually there teaching me important lessons, and that the hardships, difficulties, and challenges in this life, and that certainly includes illness and disease, which as a healer I'm very interested in those hardships, has everything to do with being opportunities for growth and for learning. And sometimes they're very difficult. I'm not saying that things are easy, but that some of these hardships and difficulties are actually there for that very reason.
Are necessary.
That we are here to learn those lessons they have to teach.
Right.
And that's what this life is all about, here.
All right.
On this
so, all right. So now we'll go from henceforth. So how have you been transformed? In what way?
Well, it basically has changed everything about the way I see everybody around me, the way I see myself, see family, see others, very much knowing the not just the physical, mental, emotional, but especially the spiritual aspects of each and every one of us, seeing each and every one as an eternal soul, knowing how reincarnation is important, and that, in fact, learning is not just limited by, okay, well, when you die, that's all gone, because, in fact, we bring back and some of this knowing back into our future incarnations. Of course, future
All right, well, that's a new issue here, is it not? Whether, you can believe in an afterlife without reincarnation?
Well, for me, it was absolutely clear that my experience was proving consciousness that is a much richer when freed up from the brain and body, and implying very strongly eternal life of spirit and soul. And there was really no way for me to see all of that and acknowledge the power, the infinite power, and infinite personal, unconditional loving nature of that God that I encountered, to reconcile those two features of love and power with the suffering of innocence, the suffering of children and animals, and to see that there was just this one physical life made no sense whatsoever. And
so you've taken essentially the Buddhist view that, and the Hindu view of karma.
Well, I think that is certainly part of it, and I would also say that I think certainly having grown up a Christian, that I'm quite convinced now, especially having read the Gnostic Gospels and become much more familiar with the Christian teachings in their pure form. You know, not necessarily filtered through the councils centuries later, that in fact Jesus knew very well of reincarnation. Of course, he is a prime example of reincarnation.
All right. Hold it there, because I want to, I guess our final segment will be on that. Coming back, the book is up at DennisPrager.com. I'm Dennis Prager, and it's gone very fast, which is a credit to my guest. Proof of Heaven is his book, the subtitle, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. It's exactly who he is, a neurosurgeon who has journeyed into the afterlife. He would have been skeptical of his own book had he not experienced it. Aben Alexander is the doctor's name. And we just have a couple of minutes, literally, and you added this fascinating addition, to be redundant for a moment, and that is that the consciousness that outlives our physical body, which otherwise we wouldn't have such a thing as obviously as a mind and as an afterlife, but it also, we do revisit this world. That's what reincarnation is, and that is how you have come better to explain the suffering of children, etc. Is that correct?
Right. That that there's no way, I mean, for one thing, going on the journey I went on, seeing that power and the unconditional love in its strength, because people don't really know it unless they've been there, just how powerful that really is. It explains everything about our religious writings, but often in a different way than we interpret. But seeing that intense and very personal love of that Creator for each and every one of us, explain so much, and especially that reincarnation had to be there, because there was no way to see the suffering of innocence, children, animals, etc., if it was just that one single pass through. And there was no way to see an eternal hell. Eternal hell made no sense whatsoever from that all-powerful Creator, because it was far too imperfect.
Wow. So finally, do you treat people differently as a result of this?
Well, totally. I mean, it has everything to do with seeing that much higher purpose, realizing that we are here to learn, we are here to face the hardships, difficulties, challenges, disease, illness, and to do it in a fashion that manifests that wonderful love of the Creator. And in fact, it has so much to do, for instance, with people who are bereaved or grieving, with knowing how that personal love for each and every one of us is so deep that that's what drives that wanting on the behalf of God for us to not forget our connection to the divine. And I make that point, I hope, clearly in my book, and talk about my own adoption story and how that served to offer up some lessons.
Well, you will have a lot of new readers as a result of this. Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. Thank you for your book, Doctor, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, and people can go to lifebeyonddeath.net to learn more.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot.
My name is Gerald Schroeder. I have a, thank God, a strong science background from MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, bachelor's, master's, PhD, 7 years in the physics staff, seen a whole range of atomic bombs detonated, moved to Israel, met my wife, Barbara Sofer, a great writer, and then teach Torah and science. So luckily, I'm lucky that I have the two that come together. And one of the questions that I'm asked as a scientist is, how can a scientist really believe that there's something that we refer to usually as God? You know, is this metaphysical whatever acting in the world or producing the world? And the irony is, the question's really a non-starter. Science has, in fact, discovered God. And you can talk to the hardline atheists, and they will say, it looks like science has indeed discovered God. And how would that be? Well, if you take the trouble of going to the web and there type in WMAP, the initials for a satellite, it's a diagram that shows the development of the universe from the creation over time. It's a timeline. Every word on that diagram comes from the NASA site. It is the condensed knowledge of the scientific community of how the universe created and how it got to where we are today. Each of the lines, the vertical lines, is another billion years. Okay, you start from a burst of energy at the extreme left side of the diagram, and you end up at the far end with the oval. The oval is to indicate expansion in all directions. Of course, because it's a timeline, we can't show that on a single piece of paper. We see here, most amazingly, that on the extreme left edge, it shows a beginning to the universe. Now, go back less than 50 years. If I were teaching that at Tech, a person could lose tenure. Saying that there was a creation of the universe. It sounds like it's Bible. Because less than 50 years ago, the overwhelming scientific opinion was the universe is eternal. There was never a beginning. The Bible is wrong from the very first sentence. And then we discovered, suddenly, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, the Bell Labs in New Jersey, the northeast of the U.S., discovered the echo of the Big Bang, the energy left over, which George Gamow, 60 years ago, predicted that if there had been a universe created hot and small, it would have exploded, and the energy would get more and more dilute. And Penzias and Wilson, these Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, discover this energy that had been predicted overnight. The Bible got it right. There was a beginning to the universe. Now, the black in the diagram is nothing. It's not a vacuum. Vacuums are within that diagram, within that cone of expansion. Vacuums are empty space, and space is something. The black of the paper around the diagram is nothing. It doesn't fit in our human brain, because humans think in a box made of time, space, and matter / energy. No human, as clever as they might be, as expansive as they might be, thinks out of that box. So when we say outside that diagram is nothing, we can use the words, but we can't conceive of nothing. It doesn't fit in the human brain. How are we going to have this idea, is there a God or not? Notice that the creation force isn't a three-letter word, G-O-D. If you look at the words carefully, it's a quantum fluctuations. That understanding was first brought down by Ed Tryon, brilliant human being, in the journal Nature almost 40 years ago. The universe allows creation of something from nothing, provided you have the laws of nature, the quantum fluctuation. Tryon realized, and he published in the journal Nature, one of the two leading peer-reviewed journals in the world, that you can create something from absolute nothing, provided you've got the laws of nature, quantum physics and the laws of relativity. In other words, the laws of nature. So look what science has discovered. We can create the universe from absolute nothing, provided we have the forces of nature. Now, the laws of nature, the forces of nature aren't physical. They act on the physical. So if they create the universe, that means they predate the universe. So now we have a set of forces, we call them the laws of nature, that are not physical, that are able to act on the physical. They create the physical from absolute nothing. And they predate the universe, which means they predate our understanding of time. Put that together, it sounds very familiar. If you haven't noticed it, That's the biblical definition of God. There's only one nuance that's left hanging. We can talk about it another time, perhaps. Is that which created the universe, those forces active in the universe? But up to that point, science says you are correct. The definition of the biblical God is predates time, outside of time. God is not a physical being, is a force, and it creates the universe. You'll notice that the opening chapter of Genesis, the only name for God is Elohim, God as manifest in the universe. Science has indeed discovered the biblical God. Well, we just need one part left, crucial. That which created the universe is also active in the universe itself. The very fact that you're watching this now pretty much establishes that point.
Welcome back. You're watching the 700 Club. We've got a fascinating guest coming up right now. Hugh Ross was 8 years old when he started saving money to buy a telescope. When he finally looked through the lens, he was amazed at the beauty of the universe. Today, he's still looking at the stars, and he says they help prove the existence of a creator.
When Dr. Hugh Ross was a young boy, he was fascinated with astronomy. Hugh read every physics book in the school library by the time he was 7. As a teen, he was convinced the Big Bang Theory was the only explanation for the origin of life, until he picked up the Bible. Since then, Dr. Ross has been providing scientific evidence of a purpose-filled universe and explains recent discoveries in his updated book, The Creator and the Cosmos.
Well, join us for more is Dr. Hugh Ross. We welcome him back to the 700 Club. Hugh, it's good to see you. Thank you. I read this book of yours. It is encyclopedic in your knowledge of everything. But let me ask you something. How big is this universe?
Well, it's about 50 billion trillion stars. Well, those stars make up a quarter of a percent of the universe.
50 billion trillion stars.
Give or take a few billion.
50 billion trillion, and that makes a quarter of the universe?
A quarter of a percent.
Quarter of a percent. What's the rest of it, dark matter? The
rest of it's dark matter and dark energy.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, where are we? How big is this Earth the planet we're on compared to that?
Well, it's a tiny speck. I mean, our planet's only 8,000 miles in diameter. And the universe is, you know, billions of light years across.
Your book basically said that God, the Creator, made all that trillions of stuff out there to support this tiny little planet we're on.
There wouldn't be a planet Earth if the universe wasn't exactly that size. Make it bigger or smaller, you don't get life. It's got to be exactly that size.
Exactly that size?
Yeah, given the laws of physics, the mass of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned. The dark energy has to be fine-tuned even more. In fact, that ranks as the most spectacular fine-tuning design we can measure anywhere in science.
Well, I mean, you and I are sitting here on television talking about this, and is it all based for us? I mean, are we the pinnacle of God's creation?
We are the whole universe, literally every component of the universe, every event in the history of the universe must be exactly the way it is in order for billions of human beings to be living in a situation where they can be redeemed from their sin. The whole universe is designed with redemption in mind. I mean, if you look at the Bible, it tells us God begins his works of redemption before he creates anything. So every part of God's creation is for the purpose of our redemption.
Every part of God. So we are
every life form, every component of the earth.
Well, I noticed in your book you talk about all these elements. What are these elements, and why are they so important? All these elements that if we had them, we didn't have them. What does it have to do with us?
Well, the mass of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned to get 94 naturally existing elements in the periodic table, and yeah, we need every one of them for advanced light to be possible.
Why? Why do we need them?
Well, I mean, your body, for example, has 22 elements in it.
Okay.
And many of those elements are what we call vital poisons. Mm-hmm. If you got too much in your body, they will kill you. Mm-hmm. If you got too few in your body, it will kill you. They have to be exactly at the right level. And we happen to be living on the one body in the universe where everything is exactly at the right level.
Well, now, there are people who, you know, believe that the Bible, that the universe is 6,000 years old because of Usher's dating. How old is the universe according to scientific knowledge?
We now know it to four places the decimal, 13.79 billion, plus or minus 0.05.
13.79,
yeah.
79 billion, 13.7?
13.79. Yeah, I tell a story there how we're now able to measure it very accurately. The Earth's age, we can measure to five places the decimal. So,
how do we get such fine tuning on? 13 billion years. How is that so fine tuned?
Well, like with the thing about, we happen to be living at the right time in the history of the universe where we can see all of the history of the universe. If we were created earlier, we'd only be seeing part of the history of the universe. If we were created later, we'd only be seeing part. We're at that one time where we can actually see the entire history of the universe and directly witness the cosmic creation event.
How do we see that? The Hubble?
The velocity of light. So when we look at a distant galaxy, we're not seeing it as it is now. We're seeing as it was when light left that galaxy. Well, we can now look so far away, we can actually watch the universe being created. We can actually get data from our telescopes that tells us the conditions of the universe when it was 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. That's so close we can get to the cosmic beginning.
Say that again, a billion.
If we can get to within 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. There's a whole chapter in this book on how we're able to do that.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and so, it's direct observations. We're not inferring it. We're directly seeing it.
We're seeing it. Oh, that's unbelievable.
Well, it's our ability to witness the cosmic creation event, which gives us such compelling proof that, indeed, we live in a universe created by God.
We live on a planet that's in a solar system that's part of a galaxy called the Milky Way. And that, in turn, is part of a spiral nebula. Tell us about that. How does that all work so we can see from where we sit the rest of it?
Well, we happen to not only live at the right time to witness the whole history of the universe. We're in the best possible place to see the whole history of the universe. We're far from the galactic center, which means we don't get blinded by the light of the bright stars there. We're halfway between two spiral arms, which again gives us a clear view of the heavens. And we happen to be living in a cluster of galaxies where there are no giant galaxies, and the galaxies are far enough apart we get a clear view of the heavens.
Well, what about our sun? Is there something unique about the sun that we have in our solar system?
Yes. The sun is remarkably stable in its luminosity, which is crucial for us to be able to have civilization. And for 60 years, my colleagues have been looking for an exact enough twin of the sun that they say maybe there could be a planet with advanced life on it. They've yet to find one.
They haven't found one. We're the only one?
We found stars that are twins of one another, but we can't find a sufficient twin of the sun that it could be a candidate.
Stephen Hawking just died. He didn't believe in a lot of these things. What was wrong with him?
Well, I got a whole chapter on Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
We're actually giving that chapter 12 away for free for anybody who wants it.
Okay.
Just go to our website, reasons.org/cc. They can get that chapter for free. I got to hear him when I was at Caltech. He spent a month out of every year at Caltech. A remarkable man. But also, he showed some humility. He said, we all think I'm so brilliant. I've got an advantage over all of the rest of you at Caltech. I can't play golf, I can't fish, I can't hike. All I can do is theoretical physics. So he says, that's why I've been able to achieve, because I'm not distracted.
Well, was he that smart or was he that stupid because of fools?
Well, he was that focused. There's plenty of physicists and astronomers that are as brilliant as he is, but he was singularly focused. And he made some remarkable discoveries. In fact, he was the one, along with Roger Penrose, that came up with the first of the space-time theorems, which shows that there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that created everything. Now, he didn't believe the implications of that, but he was the one who actually said when he was interviewed by the Reader's Digest, we proved that time is a beginning. We proved that time was created.
And there had to be a causal agent outside
exactly.
of
exactly. And that's what's unique about the God of the Bible. The gods of the other religions create within space and time. The God of the Bible creates independent of space and time. And now we got theorems that actually prove that.
Had you ever figured out why God wants to fool with us? I mean, I talked to him. I say, you know, why do you want to fool with me? I mean, I'm one of umpteen billion people on this planet, and I'm this tiny little globe I'm on. Why does God want to fool with us?
He's got a purpose for you. This isn't going to be your final career. Right. I mean, I tell believers,
yeah,
God's got a career for you in the new creation. And it's more than anything you can imagine. It's going to have incredible significance. You're going to be a teacher and a ruler over the angels themselves and over everything else God creates. God is exposing us to his grace. The angels watch the grace of God. We experience the grace of God. So this life, as brief as it is a training ground for a remarkable career that we're going to have in the new creation.
It leads to a great deal of humility, though, doesn't it? As human beings, I mean, the fact that we're special, again, it's kind of hard to understand why we would be special in the midst of this huge, huge universe. But he says, I've created all things. Heaven is my throne. Earth is my footstool. You know?
Well, I think when you look at the universe, you're forced to the conclusion we must have incredible value in God's sight. The fact that he created all of this so that we could exist and be, you know, have this training that we need to fulfill our future career.
When Einstein came up with his theory of relativity, how does that impact what we're talking about? Is there anything about what he found that's contrary to a theistic interpretation of this?
Not at all. In fact, these space-time theorems I'm talking about, they're based on the theory of general relativity. If general relativity reliably describes the movements of bodies in the universe, then there is a beginning to space and time and a creator of space and time. And today, as I talk about in this book, general relativity now ranks as the most exhaustively tested and best proven principle in all of physics. Therefore, the God of the Bible indeed exists.
How did Einstein come up with this? He's like a postal clerk over in Germany. How does he come up with these things?
Well, he was trained in physics.
Was he trained?
He was trained in physics. Yes, he was working for the patent office in Switzerland. But all on the side, he was working on this physics theory. And one personality he had great audacity. And so, yes, this is what the physics community is saying, but this is what I think the physics is saying. And he first came up with this theory of special relativity, which doesn't take a whole lot of brilliance. It's a rather simple thing to derive.
All right.
His general relativity was a remarkable achievement.
And why is that?
Well, it's much more challenging to develop that. In fact, when he first came up with it, the British mathematician, Sir Arthur Eddington, said there's only two people in the world that understand general relativity. And I'm not sure about the other guy. But today there's about 10,000 that understand general relativity.
Well, he was looking for a unified space theory, wasn't he? Incorporated time into the other.
Right, and we've made some progress towards that. But in order to really get a firm handle on a unified field theory, you need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long. And my colleagues joke that won't be funded until the Democrats control all branches of the government.
40 trillion.
40 trillion miles long. So, yeah, chances are we're never going to have a unified field theory that we're confident
about. It won't
happen.
This book, ladies and gentlemen, is called Creator of the Cosmos. It was set up like a textbook, wasn't it? I mean, it looks like it was set up for teaching people.
Well, there are study questions at the end of each chapter because we know small groups are going to want to go through this book. But it's mainly a book that believers can give to their non-Christian friends. We've seen more people come to faith in Christ through reading this book than any other book I've ever put out.
There's no conflict between true science and faith, is there, that you can see?
Well, that's how I came to faith. It was through my physics and astronomy that I realized the Bible indeed is the inspired word of God. And yeah, I was at age 19. I gave my life to Christ through signing my name in the back of a Gideon Bible. but it was based on 2 years of comparing what the Bible said about science and realizing it's the same thing.
The Bible is more valid than the theory of thermodynamics or any of these other theorems. Is that right?
What brought me to Christ was realizing that the Bible had a higher degree of reliability and trustworthiness that we could show through mathematics and what I could see in, say, the second law of thermodynamics. I said, I trust that law, therefore I have to trust what the Bible's got to say.
The book is called Creator. Where can they get this? Is this available wherever?
The Creator and the Cosmos, yes, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it from us at Reasons to Believe.
Right.
So any online thing will have that.
You know, we have a School of Divinity at Regent University, and I didn't want those people, those students, to come out with that so-called creation science that is so flawed. And I wanted to make compulsory a course on cosmology. And you're active, and could you tell us about that?
Well, thanks to you, I'm going to be giving 7 lectures here in the next few days to various groups here at Regent University. And yeah, it's a thrill to be partnered with Regent. So
well,
thank you for making that happen.
Is it helpful to the student? I mean, you know, this creation science just doesn't have it, does it? I mean, it's so full of
holes. We're talking about real creation science.
Yeah, real creation.
You know, God gave us 2 books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. And the book of nature brings us to the book of scripture. So that's mainly what I'm going to be speaking to your students and faculty about this week.
Well, I appreciate you and the tremendous wisdom that God has placed in your hand. This book is mind-boggling at the complexity of all the universe that Hugh is just talking about and the evidence for God in the universe that surrounds us. So thank you so much. God bless
you. You're welcome.
Appreciate it.